So let me just take some minutes to talk about the rulings themselves and what they say. And if you haven't read them, they are certainly interesting reading. In the Gill case, by way of background, the judge makes a point of spending some pages talking about the House report when DOMA was enacted in 1996, and as we had, of course, indicated to him, pointing out all of the kind of hateful, inflammatory, irrelevant things that Congress had to say at the time to kind of set the stage for how to think about what Congress had done here. Then he reviews the programs that we put in play, which I think you know were Social Security, filing of federal income tax, and the various benefits available to federal employees and retirees. And after he laid all that out, he then turned to the merits and acknowledged that our claim was what it was, a claim for equal protection review of Congress's action in enacting Section 3 of DOMA as applied to these particular plaintiffs with these particular federal programs. And he points out that you have to decide what the level of scrutiny is going to be, that when the courts are looking at this, they have to, in essence, how much deference are they going to give to Congress? And he acknowledges that we asked for a heightened level of scrutiny on basis of sexual orientation discrimination, on the basis of an interference with a fundamental right of family integrity, on grounds that there's federalism at play here in ways that should provoke a more searching review from the court. And he said, no, I'm not going to go there because this act of Congress can't withstand even the most deferential level of scrutiny rational basis, because even though it is very, very deferential, it is not totally blind to the circumstances and to the need for some connection between the asserted purposes and what Congress has done. And with that, then, the court launched into the substance of analyzing the potential rationales for DOMA, Section 3. And as I think you also probably know, there's been a lot of talk about the rationales put forward by Congress in 1996 and the Obama administration's essential walking away from those rationales, and they being about fostering a traditional heterosexual marriage, fostering procreation and optimal child rearing, traditional morality, and protecting the public fisc. And so even though the government disavowed them, and we decided that, you know, these things, they're just too important, and plus on a rational basis test, the court is allowed to consider any rationale that could conceivably support the law, and nothing in the government's disavowal really precluded the court from actually considering them. And so we briefed them. It annoyed the government because they said, what do I mean? We disavowed them. So they kind of reinforced their disavowal. But the judge then went on to say, well, and they don't support DOMA Section 3 at all. And you can read that. I won't go through those various rationales. And then he turned to the rationales that the government has tried to put in the place of the 96 rationales today. And primarily that was the argument that Congress in 96, looking far to the west to Hawaii and seeing what was going on in Hawaii at that time, where the Supreme Court of Hawaii had held in 1993, that it was possible. It was true that excluding same-sex couples from marriage did discriminate against same-sex couples, and therefore was at least subject to review and needed justification by the state of Hawaii, and remanded the case to the trial court for that determination. That case then sat forever and forever, but ultimately the fear of that is what prompted the passage of DOMA. And what the government now says is, well, it was reasonable for Congress to essentially hit the pause button. All hell was breaking loose, and we can say, wait. We're going to wait and see how this cultural issue plays itself out, and we're going to stick with the status quo as it existed in 1996. And they talk about, you know, Congress has the power to deal incrementally with things, and that they were interested in consistency across the board in handling marriage. Well, our answer to that was really, well, gee, that wasn't the status quo at all. The status quo was, and had been for hundreds of years in the United States, that the federal government acknowledged that determination of marital statuses was a function of the state as a sovereign, something that the federal government was not to intrude into, and that, in fact, over two centuries, the federal government, whenever it felt that it was necessary to hinge some obligation or some benefit or some protection on marital status, they simply looked to the states and to determine whether these particular citizens were married or not. And that's the way the system had worked up until 1996, when Congress suddenly thought it wasn't working so well if same-sex couples could marry. The judge, I think, this is the thing he latched onto most at the hearings, both in our case and in the AG's case, is to, well, what is the status quo? And what is the relevant status quo? And as he put it in his opinion, he said, well, the government gets this wrong because they talk about what the status quo is in the states, where that may be true, that only different sex couples could marry. But if you look at the federal status quo, which is presumably what Congress is concerned with, that status quo was recognizing a marriage if a state married a couple. And that, in fact, what Section 3 did was upend the status quo. And so he kind of goes through a number of explanations for why he does not find that persuasive or even rational. And then he finds that it certainly isn't incremental because, as we pointed out in one sentence and he quotes back, DOMA Section 3 is not incremental at all. It, with a broad brush, wipes out any protection or recognition of the marriages of same-sex couples across the board for those 1,138 rights the number that continually gets spouted because of the Congressional Budget Office reports. And as to consistency, he also points out the flaws in the government argument that, in fact, consistency existed when all marriages were respected by the federal government if they were acknowledged and created by the states, and now we have a totally inconsistent system in light of DOMA Section 3. And so he frames the analysis pretty nicely by Romer, the kind of the first big U.S. Supreme Court case, which was somewhat gay-affirming, and he starts by quoting Romer that the Constitution neither knows nor tolerates classes among citizens. And that was Justice Kennedy in Romer citing Justice Harlan in dissent in Plessy versus Ferguson from 1899, I believe it was, when the court, over his dissent, upheld segregated railroad cars. And he then brings it around at the end to make a point made by a very conservative, well, I shouldn't say very conservative, I don't know him, but by a conservative judge in the South on a federal court of appeals who really didn't like this notion that there was some kind of quote-unquote rational basis with teeth, that there were circumstances and when you could look for animus and you could talk about that. But what he did say is this judge's understanding of Romer was that if you look at the rationales put forward by Congress or any of the ones that you can think of, and none of them make any sense, if all of them seem wholly attenuated and unrelated to what the government says it's trying to do, then you are left with only one inference. And the inference then is that Congress has acted with animus simply to harm a particular group of people. And everybody agrees, right, whether you're conservative or liberal, that that is an unconstitutional act of Congress. And that's exactly what this conservative judge would say Romer did under a very, very deferential rational basis review. And that's what Judge Toro here says ultimately when I go through this whole exercise of assessing these rationales. That's the only conclusion I can come to, too. I mean, we kind of like it because we think it sets the stage to say, you know, this isn't some kind of liberal activism. This is even the answer under the most exacting deferential standard of review. And then let me just say a few things about the Attorney General's case. Again, the judge, in that opinion, instead of doing the background on the House report, he does the background on the history of marital status determination, something that we've invested a lot of time in, and the Attorney General did too, to show how exactly true it is that over the course of our country's history, the states have determined marital statuses. There has been a lot of conflict over marital statuses. So as where the government suddenly says, oh, my goodness, we had to do something, Congress had to do something here because there was all this cultural turmoil over same-sex couples marrying, and it was right to hit the pause button. Well, you know, the fact is there has been a huge amount of conflict in America over marital statuses over time. And, you know, it's fun and interesting to read about. And the judge really focuses on interracial marriage, but just to show that, in fact, we've had huge controversy over it. And despite that, despite the fact that, you know, when Loving versus Virginia was decided, we still had more than a dozen states that banned interracial marriage, even though that issue had been going back and forth for over a century prior to that, that the federal government never worried about that cultural issue. If your state married you as an interracial couple, federal government treated you as married. If they didn't marry you, they didn't treat you as married. It was as simple as that. And so he points all that out, and then he turns to the programs that the Attorney General was suing about, which is veteran cemeteries and Medicaid, which is called MassHealth here, Medicare taxes paid by the Commonwealth for its employees. And then for the Commonwealth case turns not to equal protection, but to what was the key issue there, which is what are the boundaries between state power and federal power? And put one way, it's a question of whether the reserved powers of the states under the 10th Amendment were intruded upon by the federal government, or whether you look at the flip, as he said, the flip side of the coin, can the federal government say it has an enumerated power in the Constitution to support what it did? And that would be the government said under the spending clause, which allows the government essentially to spend its money for the general welfare of the United States. And again, the judge analyzed that question, and it's caused a good deal of controversy since Thursday when this decision came down. But he based it upon something that we think is absolutely true. Marital status is an attribute of state sovereignty. Every U.S. Supreme Court judge who has had to opine on this question has agreed, again, conservative or liberal, Congress does not have power to create marital statuses. And so people can disagree about how this issue plays out, but in fact, that was the crux of what Judge Taro agreed with and said that, you know, the spending power does not go this far. And in that sense, he pulled in the equal protection provision because one of the limits on the spending power is the federal government, when it spends its money, can tell the states how to spend it and put conditions on how they spend it. But the one thing they can't do, or one of the things that they cannot do, is put a condition on spending that would require a state to violate the constitutional rights of its citizens. So, I mean, if it's illegal for the federal government to wiretap American citizens, it would be illegal for the federal government to grant millions of dollars to the states for telecommunications programs and say, ah, but you can't have the money unless you wiretap our citizens. They can't do an end run that way. And that's what, and in that case, the judge here pulls in the equal protection analysis he used in our Gill case to say, essentially, that the federal government is making Massachusetts violate the constitutional rights of its own citizens by, for example, burying the spouses of heterosexual veterans in state veteran cemeteries, but having to choose either to not bury the spouses of its gay and lesbian citizens or lose all the money that has been given to the state to help establish these cemeteries that the federal government wanted to be in place.